Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage pediatric endocrinologist, Dr. Matthew Benson. We had a request from a couple of listeners to talk about thyroid disease, and although we've done that in the past, in the 10-plus years I've been doing this program, I thought it was reasonable to go and approach that again, but we've never done it from a pediatric standpoint. That doesn't mean you can't call and ask questions about other endocrine problems and even maybe some adult issues. I'm sure Matthew will do his best, and if we can't answer your question, we'll let you know that. If you have questions or comments during the next hour, you can reach us a couple of ways. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And if you're familiar with addresses on the internet, you want to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Benson, it's a pleasure to have you come on board here.
Thad, thanks for having me.
So you haven't been up here for that long, a couple of years?
About 2 years now.
And you did your training at Florida for the most part. You did medical school in Israel and then did everything else at the University of Florida?
Yeah, and I Nemours Children's Clinic also was part of my fellowship training. Okay. It was kind of a joint program between the University of Florida College of Medicine in Jacksonville and the Nemours Children's Clinic, which is a large multi-state subspecialty provider that's based in Florida, Delaware, up and down the East Coast.
Yeah, I think of Delaware because I know they have a big pediatric educational website.
Kids Health.
Kids Health, which is an excellent source of information about pediatric information.
Most definitely, and a good source for thyroid-related issues as well.
You know, I didn't put that down on our links. We do have a number of links. If you go to our website at alaskapublic.org and then look for the Line 1 website, but there are some links here about pediatric endocrinology, thyroid disorders, which I pulled some stuff from Children's Hospital, and then another reliable source as well. So tell us a little bit. I haven't asked this question of a guest in a long time. Let's remind listeners what it takes, how long it takes, what you go through to get to where you are right now and start practicing endocrinology.
Yeah, it's a long process. I spent 4 years of college, a couple years of graduate school, 4 years of medical school, and then post-medical school training in pediatrics for virtually all the pediatric subspecialties. It involves, 3 years of general residency training, which qualifies us as general pediatricians. I actually spent about a year in private practice and then decided to go back and do a fellowship, which is basically 3 more years. We spend about 18 months of that fellowship in clinic and then about 18 months in research. As part of the American Board of Pediatrics now, you have to have a research publication by the end of your fellowship to be able to sit for the board exam. So it's a long process.
Mm-hmm. So I didn't realize you went out in private practice for a while, and you also had some graduate school stuff. What is it reasonable to ask what got you turned on about endocrinology versus all the other subspecialties in general pediatrics?
Yeah, honestly, I'm pretty open with this with most of my patients, but I'm a type 1 diabetic.
Ah.
And so from the age of 19, mm-hmm. I started getting those symptoms of juvenile diabetes and sort of got interested in endocrinology, took some graduate courses between college and medical school in that area, and always had sort of an interest in it. Mm-hmm. And when I went out into private practice, I worked in Western North Carolina in a small community, and they figured, well, you're a diabetic. So they started sending me every child in the practice that had type 1 diabetes. And my feeling was, wow, I don't want to take care of diabetic children. I deal with that every day myself. But after spending some time with those kids, I realized, I think I could really help mm-hmm. these children. And mm-hmm. so the opportunity came back to head back to Jacksonville and work with my mentor, Nellie Maross, at Nemours Children's Clinic. And that's how I ended up. But I love what I'm doing. It's very interesting. I find it very rewarding. We have a very large amount of pharmacopoeia. We have a lot of opportunities to treat our patients. There's very little, you know, if they're making too much of something, we can take it away. If they don't have enough, we can generally replace it. So it's very rewarding to be able to help your patients and intervene and help restore health through appropriate hormone treatment. Yeah.
You know, a lot of physicians tell me a similar story. It's just that reward. And unfortunately, you know, we're not still curing a lot, although we're getting better, but it's being able to get somebody on some kind of treatment that clearly makes a big difference in their lives is really rewarding. I think probably the main reason most physicians go into medicine in the first place.
Well, most definitely. And I find it, you know, it's a very interesting field. There's lots of developments, lots of things changing. There's a lot of very bright people trying to design better ways of treating kids and mm-hmm. trying to identify problems and whatnot. But yeah. I think it's a very enjoyable field.
It's a very exciting time. Lots of interesting ideas in diabetes, but we don't have to go there. I think what we want to do, or what I'd like to do, is I promised to talk about thyroid disease. But before we get there, tell us a little bit about the kinds of disorders you're treating on a regular basis as a pediatric endocrinologist in Anchorage, Alaska.
You know, I don't think it's very different than anywhere else I've been in the United States. We see a lot of kids with certainly hypothyroidism, mostly acquired forms of hypothyroidism. We see children with growth hormone deficiency. About half the patients we're seeing have juvenile diabetes. Probably about 10% of our diabetes population is what we would call more of the typical adult onset type 2 diabetes that's associated with obesity. We see a wide range of kids with brittle bones, kids with things like osteogenesis imperfecta. We see children who have had osteopenia from chemotherapy and radiation. We see children with growth hormone deficiency and short stature. We see children with adrenal problems, including things like congenital adrenal hyperplasia and those sorts of issues. So really the whole spectrum, craniopharyngiomas occasionally, kids with pituitary hormone deficiency congenitally, quite a wide range of areas.
Okay. Let me remind our listeners once more that you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. We're originating from KSKA in Anchorage. My guest is Dr. Matthew Benson, a pediatric endocrinologist here in Anchorage. If you've got questions or comments, particularly about thyroid disease, which is where we're going to try to focus, but we're willing to take some other calls about endocrine disorders if you have them. Our local number is 550-8433. Once more, 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So I like to get to basics, and I guess one way I thought about getting there is if you would take us on an endocrinologic tour of the human body briefly. Where are these organs that give us endocrinologic problems, and how do they function?
Okay, well, not a very a very broad question. I like to let's start at the top of the head. So I always point to the bridge of my nose and say, you know, a couple inches behind your nose is a very important gland called the pituitary gland. This is a gland that we used to call many years ago sort of the master gland of the body, and it's responsible for secreting a number of hormones that are involved in regulating the thyroid. So that's pretty pertinent to our discussion today. It makes a hormone called TSH, or thyroid stimulating hormone. And this would travel from the pituitary gland to the level of the thyroid gland, which is located at the base of the neck. The pituitary gland also secretes other hormones that are involved in water balance, known as antidiuretic hormone. This is a hormone that basically helps us to better concentrate our urine and not have a very large urine output. The pituitary gland also secretes a hormone called ACTH, which is called adrenocorticotrophic hormone, and it's a hormone that's involved with helping our body to deal with stress. And it's particularly important. You can't have a pressor response to adrenaline without cortisol. So children who have a brain tumor, let's say, that was impacting their pituitary gland and they couldn't make enough ACTH to stimulate their adrenal glands, which are located above the kidneys, to make cortisol, then that could be an issue. Pituitary also makes a hormone that's very essential for growth called growth hormone. So that's the pituitary gland. We also deal, like I said, with the thyroid gland, which is a butterfly-shaped gland sort of at the base of the neck. Typically, adult size is about 20 grams in weight. One of the ways we tell people that, you know, typically the thyroid lobe, each lobe is about as big as your fifth finger. And so that can give you a sense on typically how large it is. It's a gland that receives a huge amount of blood supply, and it makes a very essential hormone called thyroid hormone. We also deal with the pancreas, of course, predominantly in diabetes. We have to remember there's an endocrine part of the pancreas and an exocrine part of the pancreas. We primarily deal with the hormones that help to balance our carbohydrates, so like insulin, but there's a number of other hormones made in the pancreas as well. Interestingly enough, the largest endocrine organ in the body is the GI tract. One of the pediatric gastroenterologists who I used to work with would often joke to us about that, you know, they do manage, but we're learning a lot more now about the gut hormones and how they impact our appetite and how they impact insulin secretion and a host of other things. We also deal with the adrenal gland, which I said was a small sort of triangular-shaped gland that sits on top of the kidney. And this is the gland that's responsible for causing adrenarche in kids. And this is often something that people confuse. You know, things like pubic hair, body odor, acne, these are things that are primarily driven by sex hormones made by the adrenal glands. And it just happens that in most individuals, they start getting pubic hair and body odor and acne when they start puberty. But they're actually two separate processes. Development of pubic hair has nothing to do with really puberty. Puberty is driven by the brain most of the time physiologically. Mm-hmm. There's some pulses of these hormones in the brain that are also made by the pituitary, known as FSH and LH, and they help us to regulate the timing of puberty. And it just happens that in most people, they start getting pubic hair at the time they start to develop breast buds in girls or testicular enlargement in boys, which is the signs of puberty. But those would be the major classes of hormones, I think, that we would deal with.
So there's this, in a sense, we don't use the term as much, or we don't hear it as much, master gland, the pituitary, because it's kind of somewhat driven by some upstream things in the brain, as we know now.
Most definitely, yeah. The hypothalamus, which already makes its own set of peptides and hormones that are often secreted, plus electrical signaling and a host of other complicated processes that are just beginning to really be delved into and understood. But yeah, clearly it's the brain and the hypothalamus that drives much of what happens in the pituitary gland.
And so this pituitary is communicating with these various glands that you've just mentioned through hormones. And then there's a feedback mechanism that's pretty classic or characteristic mm-hmm. of the endocrine system that let's just briefly mention. So when we start talking about TSH and thyroids and
most
so forth,
definitely,
we can understand what these numbers and things mean.
So I think the thyroid's probably the simplest place you can see that. And since we're going to be focusing that today on the program, I think it'd be good for people to understand that. So the hypothalamus secretes a hormone called TRH, or thyrotropin-releasing hormone, and then that travels to the pituitary gland. The pituitary gland then makes a hormone called TSH. And that TSH, there are receptors in the skin and other places, but the primary classic place that we think about those being present would be in the thyroid gland itself. So you're talking about something that's at the base of your brain. This hormone travels through the blood to the thyroid gland. The thyroid gland then makes hormones called T4 and T3. And thyroid hormone exists in those basic two forms in the body. About 10 to 25% of the thyroid hormone production is T3, which is the active form of thyroid hormone. It's really a chemical modification of that thyroid hormone structure. But the thyroid hormone predominantly secretes T4. And so when we put a patient on medication and replace that thyroid hormone, or a patient's thyroid is making it on their own, that T3 is then measured in the brain. And so the stimulation then to produce TSH is then decreased, and that's how the body kind of balances things out. So the brain is sensing those levels, and it drives the demand and it drives the need for thyroid hormone. So as the thyroid hormone then reaches the appropriate concentration that the body wants, the body then sort of gradually reduces the TSH production and sort of keeps the levels of thyroid hormone in balance.
Which gets to the reason for measuring TSH and T4 or T3 is given one of those numbers often, but usually sometimes two, you have a pretty good indication of what's going on in the thyroid gland.
Most definitely. And in most people, you know, the levels of T4 or what we call the free hormone levels, because you have to realize, too, the body works very hard to keep these things in a steady balance and to not have excessive levels just floating around random in the blood, because they're potent chemicals. They do a lot of different things. But thyroid hormone travels bound to predominantly something called thyroxine-binding globulin, but it also binds to albumin and one other protein in the blood that's escaping me at this moment. But generally, so the body works very hard to keep these things regulated. And those bound protein hormones serve as another source of it, because as they release that hormone, then it's free. It's not bound to that protein anymore, and it's able to do what it does, which is travel inside the cell and regulate gene expression in the nucleus of a cell.
So, let's talk about thyroid hormone then, and its purpose and what it's helping us do and where it's helping us do those things.
Yeah. So, it's what we call a steroid hormone in the sense that when thyroid hormone is present, it travels to the cells where it's needed, and inside those cells it regulates different genes and different gene expression. And so basically and we know that the predominant areas where it does its work is helping with cholesterol levels and metabolism, energy levels, things that help your body deal with getting energy and using various sources of energy. So that's primarily what thyroid hormone does. To make it simpler, though, for people, I think that's kind of an abstract thing, because in a lot of ways it is abstract, because there's probably a couple hundred genes or more that are regulated by thyroid hormone. So it's very complicated. But I always think in kids, it comes down to two basic things. And really, you need enough thyroid hormone to have normal growth, and you need enough thyroid hormone to have pubertal progression and to be able to have normal puberty. And then for girls, for example, to have regular menstrual cycles. So if you don't have those hormones in balance, you can't have those other normal physiologic processes occurring like they should.
All right, so let's move to imbalance. Let's talk about hypothyroidism, which means not making enough thyroid hormone. What are the characteristic symptoms that people might experience, and then the tests that might be done to help figure
yes.
that out?
Well, that's very important, because one of the most important areas of advancement, I would probably say, in the last 50 years in pediatrics has been newborn screening programs. Mm-hmm. And so with thyroid hormone especially, when children are, say, born without a thyroid gland, which is probably on the order of 1 in 2,000 to 1 in 4,000 kids, that's a preventable cause of mental retardation. So myelination, or a fatty substance in the brain that is attached to nerves in the developing brain, the brain can't grow, the brain can't develop normally without enough thyroid hormone. So for an infant, what hypothyroidism could look like is the child may not grow well, they can start to get coarsening of the facial features, they can have an unusual cry, they can have widening of the sutures in their skull, they can actually develop a multitude of other problems, but it's called cretinism, and these are the kinds of things that we hope we never have to see again. Every child that's born in a hospital in the United States gets tested for that at birth, and so we can very reliably identify those kids, and now we're even identifying some kids that have much more mild disease instead of the severe disease. But because we do that, we're preventing mental retardation in kids. Now, older kids and up to adolescence and then through into adulthood, you know, the typical symptoms of subtle weight gain. When you become severely hypothyroid, you can start to develop like these proteoglycan-like substances inside some of your cells. That causes mild amounts of water retention. But there is a big misnomer in the general population that, if I'm hypothyroid, I must be overweight or gaining weight. But that's often not very true. Things like hair loss, fatigue, inability to focus, dry skin, constipation, things along those lines. So it's one of those conditions where there are very, there can be often be very subtle features. And in children that are finished with growth, so at the end of puberty, it can be very hard to differentiate what's going on. So it's often something that you rely on a blood test to do. But for kids that aren't growing or sustaining a normal rate of growth, or kids that are delayed in their puberty, so a girl who's 13 and has no sign of puberty, or a boy who's 14 and has no sign of puberty, that could be a sign that there's a thyroid problem. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's important to get identified. Mm-hmm. Because I've seen children who are, you know, 7, 8 years old, or even 3 or 4 years of hypothyroidism, and they have very minimal growth, and they lose a lot of height potential because nobody thought about their thyroid hormone. So I think one important way for people to make sure that this gets identified is to make sure their pediatricians are doing accurate heights. Best way is obviously with like a stadiometer or something like that, but that they have at least a yearly visit with their pediatrician so they can get a yearly checkup with height and weight and things like that. Because what we said, a lot of it's metabolism. And so height, weight, growth, very good markers of identifying kids with hypothyroidism.
You've brought up a number of issues. One's the growth issue, and how do you get suspicious by growth charts that have really been done well? Diagnosing or the symptoms, and how often does obesity present as the primary symptom of hypothyroidism? But before we get to those, if I can remember to, I want to go back to this newborn issue with hypothyroidism. So let's say 1 in 2,000, 1 in 4,000 infants are born that really have not developed a thyroid gland, and if they're born, once they're born, they can't make it, and so they led to the traditional what's called cretinism or cretins, which are severely, profoundly retarded children, which we just don't see anymore, and that's because of this testing. It raises the question, what about before birth? How's the brain sustained itself in growth if there's no thyroid hormone being made by the baby?
Well, before birth, I mean, basically, the baby depends on the mother for the thyroid hormones. So some of these small amounts of these hormones will pass through the placenta. But we're learning now, even in many new studies that have been done recently, I just reviewed some papers last week for a consult I had done in the hospital, and even these premature infants that are adjusted gestational age of 29, 30 weeks, they've done studies where they do testing where we give a hormone called TRH to a kid, and then they measure the TSH response. And we're seeing that these kids, even at 30 weeks, by that age, they definitely have the ability to make TSH, and their thyroid has an ability to respond to it. Much earlier in the pregnancy, we think that is largely provided by the mother. And that's a reason that OBGYNs are periodically checking mom's thyroid hormones during the pregnancy as well.
And I couldn't remember the answer to the question is the reason I wrote it. I just figured it was the maternal thyroid hormone that sustained thyroid function in the infant. So just to make it also clear, these newborn metabolic screens are those heel sticks that babies get in the hospital, and then they're asked to repeat within 2 to 3 weeks again for some other reasons, and really not particularly necessarily with thyroid. But these are tests that are done to find what I tell parents is fairly uncommon, some quite rare, but very hard to make the diagnosis on, or very important to make the diagnosis very quickly to sustain good health. I'd say that generally enough, but yeah. I mean, there can be nasty, nasty illnesses, and the idea hopefully to find those as quickly as we possibly can.
Most definitely, and that's why I think it's good that, you know, this is done standard in the hospital, so all children that are born in a hospital, and I generally think that's the safest place for a kid to be born is obviously at the hospital, but, you know, that testing will get done, and those things can get identified. It's ran out of the OHSU, so the testing is actually done in Oregon, but they provide an excellent service to the state, and we communicate regularly with their lab.
It's a state law in every state to have some of these done. I think probably thyroid testing is probably universal in all of them, and then it may vary from state to state what other disorders that are tested for. So what causes hypothyroidism after birth?
Okay. There can be many different things. Obviously, you know, there's rare things like people who have had radiation. There are inherited conditions that we sort of call thyroid dyshormonogenesis. The process of manufacturing thyroid hormone within the thyroid gland is a very complex process, really, of iodine and chemical modification of that iodine, attaching that product to the storage protein where thyroid hormone is stored, called thyroglobulin. But this is a very complicated process, and we know there are rarely people that have genetic defects, where they often have people that have just, and this can be from mild to severe. One of them is, say, Pendred syndrome. This is a syndrome that can be also associated with deafness. But in general, that's pretty rare. The most common reason people become hypothyroid now, and iodine deficiency worldwide is very common, but that's very uncommon in the United States because of iodized salt, and we have a lot of sea life and people eating seafood, so the diet is typically quite replete in iodine. But in our country, autoimmune hypothyroidism, or something called Hashimoto's thyroiditis, I believe it was a Japanese physician many years ago who discovered this, but it's basically the body identifies certain proteins within the thyroid gland as sort of like a foreign invader or a germ or something, and so the immune system goes into the thyroid gland, and this it begins to cause by ultrasound, what we call a heterogeneous appearance to the thyroid gland, where it can kind of start to look moth-eaten. Classically, they can end up with a big goiter, and then as more of the thyroid gland is destroyed, they become hypothyroid. But Hashimoto's disease, or acquired autoimmune hypothyroidism, as we like to call it, is really the most common by far of all the etiologies we see kids for. Acquired hypothyroidism.
So the mechanism there is very much like type 1 diabetes, is an autoimmune. For reasons that are not entirely clear yet, the immune system, instead of attacking foreign invaders and tissue that is not your own, begins to attack itself. That's why it's called autoimmune.
Exactly.
And the classic disorders are type 1 diabetes, where the I guess it's proteins in the islet cells of the pancreas, that endocrine function of the pancreas, get destroyed.
Exactly.
And as a result, insulin production decreases. And then thyroid, same thing. You mentioned the term goiter. What is goiter? We used to hear a lot more about goiter. We don't hear so much about goiter anymore.
Goiter just refers to enlargement of the thyroid gland. Okay. So if I told you before that, you know, a typical adult gland is about 20 grams in weight, in a child, it would be smaller. In an older child, it could be bigger. And in a child with a very large gland, it can be 40, 50, 60 grams in size. But it just what it really is referring to is just enlargement of the thyroid tissue.
Okay. We are about halfway through our program, and typically those of you who listen know we take a break about this time, so I want to do that. I want to remind listeners once again, this is Line 1, your health connection. We're originating from KSKA in Anchorage. Our local number is 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and an email address where we can answer your questions and comments for the next 30 minutes or so. That email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this very short break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Matthew Benson on thyroid disease. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and today I'm discussing thyroid disease and other endocrine questions that might come up with our local endocrinologist, pediatric endocrinologist, Dr. Matthew Benson. You can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org, or you can call us at our local number, 550-550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And the usual warning, if you're listening between 9 and 10 p.m. on Monday night, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, and we ain't going to be able to answer your questions. So if you got those questions, call or email right now. And please remember, you know, at any time you can go to www.alaskapublic.org, hit the Line 1 link, and you will find links to other programs in our archives that are easily to be listened to again, or you can stir or steer some of your friends or people you want to listen to a particular program to that location. If you're really diligent, you can find the programs also on iTunes, those of you who are able to do or know how to do that. So back to this hypothyroidism. We've talked about thyroid. We talked about how hormones react or interact or control each other from the pituitary gland. So for the thyroid gland, if we're not making enough thyroid hormone, a doctor might measure the TSH, or thyroid stimulating hormone. And if there's not enough thyroid hormone being made, the TSH should be higher than normal.
That's correct.
That's what gives us that hint that something's not right. So really, the one number, that TSH, is something that drives a lot of decisions. But then there's a lot of other tests sometimes to figure out, is it this autoimmune or Hashimoto's thyroiditis, what the cause is. But the TSH is really a critical way to get a quick insight of whether you got too much or too little or normal amounts of thyroid hormone.
That's correct. If the TSH is elevated, well above the normal range, which is typically somewhere between 0.5 and 5 is sort of typically the normal range for TSH for most ages of children, the elevation of the TSH indicates that there's something primary with the thyroid. Obviously, like I said before, if someone has a brain tumor and they can't make TSH and they have a low thyroid hormone and a normal or a low TSH, that would indicate that the problem is at the level of the brain or the hypothalamus. So that TSH is very critical in helping us figure out, is this the problem with the thyroid gland or is this the problem with the brain signaling?
Okay. So the opposite of not making enough thyroid hormone is making too much, and then we call that hyperthyroiding. How interesting. So tell us about hyperthyroidism. What are the symptoms here, and you know, what's the causes?
Yeah, so hyperthyroidism, again, this is where there's too much thyroid hormone. So in this condition, people can have oily skin, they can have diarrhea, they can start to develop a rapid heartbeat and have chest pain or palpitations, things of that nature. For girls who are menstruating, they could have heavier periods or lack of periods. You can kind of have a mixture of both. But those would be the typical symptoms. You can develop, of course, high fever and blood pressure elevation. If the hyperthyroidism gets very, very severe, you can end up with a thyroid storm, things of that nature. The most common reason that we really see kids with hyperthyroidism is due to another autoimmune disease, which is really the relative of Hashimoto's thyroiditis that we talked about. And if you talk to endocrinologists that practiced 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, they really thought of Hashimoto's thyroiditis and Graves' disease as really the same disease with different types of antibodies. So in Hashimoto's thyroiditis, you have elevated antithyroglobulin antibody and elevated antithyroid peroxidase antibody much of the time. In Graves' disease, you actually have antibodies that stimulate the thyroid gland independent of TSH or independent of any of the brain signals. So those thyroid-stimulating immunoglobulins can be measured on a test called TSI, and they can also be measured through some newer testing now that's probably a bit more reliable, called TSH receptor antibodies. And they basically, when these are present in high concentrations in the blood, they basically tell the thyroid gland to make more thyroid hormone independent of how much thyroid hormone is in the blood. And so obviously then these patients can come in with severe hyperthyroidism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't see a lot of thyroid disease in private practice, but I've seen some hypo. I only can recall one hyperthyroid. It was pretty dramatic, and the person had been sick for a while. It was a teenage girl who was, you know, very revved up, tachycardic, mm-hmm. Didn't feel well, losing mm-hmm. weight. It was it was impressive.
Oh yes, and it is very impressive. And when they come in, you know, occasionally, and I've seen a couple kids, you know, go into mild thyroid storm or even heart failure. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, children are pretty healthy. Mm-hmm. When this happens to an adult who may be older and not quite as healthy, most of our kids, though, mm-hmm. they can go for quite a long period of time mm-hmm. because they have a healthy heart and they're able to deal with that extra stress. But it can be quite impressive.
So again, for listeners, with your hyperthyroidism, you're making too much thyroid hormone, so your TSH level will be lower than normal. It's not getting the signal that says you need to make more. So again, the TSH is a critical value to look at. And I want to come back to that. I'm going to come back to that in a minute because I want to ask about a disorder called subclinical hypothyroidism, which maybe getting a little deep, but I think it's worth talking about. But before we do that, I want to take a phone call that's come in. Therese, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, hi. I was just diagnosed with hyperthyroid recently, last February, and I've been... can you hear me?
Yes, sure can.
Yeah, and it's the Shimoto disease is with it. I can't pronounce it correctly.
Hashimoto's?
Yes, mm-hmm. And they have me on the thyroid Synthroid, and it seems like my body is fighting this, and it's like the whole year I was like on and off sick from taking this, and they had me on 50 mg, and then I went up to 75, and then I went back down, and I was wondering, is there an alternative to the medication? Is there something else I can do? I feel like I'm just in the kind of shooting, barriers and then coming back, really affecting my life.
Okay. So the diagnosis was hypothyroidism. You had a low thyroid hormone. Is that right? Matthew answer this, but at the beginning of an inflammation of the thyroid, your high hormone may go up for a while, and then it kind of burns out, so to speak, is the way I think of it, and gets low again. And usually Synthroid is, I think of it as being used when you have a low amount. So that's why I wanted to get it clarified. But let me get a pro asking you the questions and see if we can help you here.
Yeah. How old are you?
I am 40. How old am I? 48.
Okay. And that's kind of the classic age that many women would be diagnosed with acquired hypothyroidism or Hashimoto's thyroiditis. I mean, I've heard of it as many as 5-10% of women. I mean, it can be very, very common, very, very. And so it sounds like you've had elevated markers in your body, so they probably did the thyroglobulin antibodies and the thyroid peroxidase antibodies, and that just tells us that your immune system was doing some damage to your gland. And those doses that, you know, that you were on are fairly low doses, especially for an adult person. Now, there is a lot of controversy, but I don't think it's within the mainstream of adult or pediatric endocrinology, but many times patients request being put on thyroid hormone other than the synthetic thyroid hormone that's widely available. This is known as, the drug name is Synthroid, which is sort of the trade name, but the generics that are available, levothyroxine being the most common, this is a generic form of the medication. And those that typically when it's dosed, you know, people generally do well and they feel well, but there are a small number of patients who still on those medications may not always feel right. I think it's wise to periodically get your levels checked, so to check your TSH and free T4. So maybe if you're not feeling well, go back to your physician who prescribed the medication and just say, hey, you know, it's been a period of time. Usually about a month after you start treatment is a good time to get it checked again, just to make sure that you're not overtreated. If you still continue to feel tired or fatigued or, you know, having hair loss and other symptoms, you know, you can talk about other options. We used to get thyroid hormone from animal sources. And the problem with that is there is the most active form of thyroid hormones also present in that. And I've found from my experience, when I start giving those forms of thyroid hormone to children, it's very difficult to regulate them because you can't always control how much T3 is in that specimen because it came from an animal source and it wasn't completely purified. And now that we can make thyroid hormone sort of in a lab and we have a very good supply of it, it's generally much easier to treat people with the levothyroxine that is the prescription. And for those patients that still continue to feel tired or fatigued, you know, there is T3 that you can treat people with. But again, it's something I generally try to avoid because it's very hard to regulate. And many of those patients end up over suppressing their TSH, which isn't good for their heart or their bones long term. So I have a lot of reservations about doing that. And vast majority of patients can do just fine on T4. Because their body can make T3 from the T4 that they're getting from the prescription medication.
Okay.
So, Therese, what I'm hearing, and let me make sure you're hearing the same thing, is that it's a little unusual if you're being treated with the right amounts and everything to be having problems. Doesn't mean it can't happen, but I guess what I hear Dr. Benson saying is, first off, you want to make sure that your levels are good, that indicates you are getting appropriate treatment before messing around with other different treatments. Is that right?
Most definitely.
Yep.
Okay. Yes. Well, thank you. I appreciate that input on that.
Okay. And we're going to have another question come up just shortly about thyroid hormone and natural hormones. You may want to listen to this one, too. Good luck, Therese. All right, so we had an email. It says, I had hyperthyroidism, and after radiation treatment, I now have hypothyroidism. My doctor has me on Synthroid. I brought up the natural Synthroid, and he was totally against it. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think what we're talking about basically is that the sources, what is called natural thyroid hormone is virtually identical to what we give out in Synthroid or levothyroxine, apart from the fact that some of the animal-based Synthroid, because it's extract from a cow thyroid or some other animal, there's T3 present in there. We talked about how typically your body makes T4 in a very steady supply from the first year of life pretty much all the way through adulthood in a very, very steady level. And your body then is able to make T3, that active form of thyroid hormone, through complicated processes. There are these enzymes called iodinases, and they chemically modify that, and they can turn it into active thyroid hormone. When we give people active thyroid hormone, it's very hard to adjust it, frankly, because the body naturally does that on its own anyway, because very little of the natural thyroid hormone made in your thyroid is T3. It's a very small amount, probably 10 to 15% of all the thyroid hormone made by the gland. So the body seems to have a residual ability just to make that on its own. And so generally speaking, like I said, probably 90%+ of all the patients, they can do just fine on Synthroid. And a side note, radioactive iodine ablation is probably one of the best ways we have of treating Graves' disease and hyperthyroidism. And if we treat in the appropriate doses and we destroy the gland, that's good for several reasons. One, it probably lowers your risk of thyroid cancer later on, because you have little functional thyroid tissue. And without Synthroid, you would have to be on, that indicates, you know, that you don't have much functional thyroid tissue left. And that helps us to know that basically, you know, your thyroid gland has largely been destroyed. So actually, I personally underwent radioactive iodine ablation. I developed Graves' disease after I got diabetes. And I think for many, many patients, it's a very good solution.
Which brings up the point that often people who have one autoimmune disease are at increased risk of having other autoimmune diseases. Is that fair to say?
Most definitely.
Okay. So that if you have an autoimmune thyroid disorder or diabetes, then keeping a high awareness of the development of other endocrine problems of a similar nature should be thought about.
Most definitely.
All right, so we briefly talked about treatment of hyperthyroidism, so I'm going to jump up to something called thyroid nodules. I had a teenage girl not too long ago came in with a mass in her thyroid, and we did some workup and tried to do some stuff about it and drain it and still had some continued pain, and eventually had to have this thing taken out. What's a thyroid nodule?
So a thyroid nodule is really, it's something that occasionally we can feel, and it's just basically an area of irregularity in the thyroid tissue. Normally the thyroid is fairly soft, and when we feel the thyroid on someone's neck, we usually do it from the back or with extension of the neck so that their chin's pointed up. And it's just basically an irregularity. Now, it can be seen best with an ultrasound. And basically what we worry about are solid nodules on ultrasound. Nodules that have calcifications in them, nodules that have an irregular border, nodules that are greater in height than width, and there's a whole host of other radiographic criteria that make us worried about thyroid nodules. Practically, though,
what's the worry about the thyroid nodules?
Well,
if they have those,
a subset of patients that have them have cancer in their thyroid gland.
Right. So one reason for that nodule would be a cancer.
Most definitely.
Okay. All right.
And there's various forms of thyroid cancer, papillary thyroid carcinoma being the most common. But those who have a nodule, and usually what we worry about are nodules that are greater than a centimeter in size, those are ones that we often would recommend someone have like a fine needle aspiration done to see if there's any cancerous tissue there. Mm-hmm. There's obviously false positive, false negative with that, but in general, that's a fairly good way to screen it. It's usually done ultrasound guided, and that way we can, but thyroid nodules can also exist in Hashimoto's disease. They can also exist in the general population. So they're probably fairly common. And we know in children as compared to adults, in adults, maybe 10% of all thyroid nodules are cancerous. In kids, upwards of a quarter of them. If they're large nodules, they can actually be cancerous. So they do require some heightened surveillance and appropriate monitoring to make sure that they're not growing rapidly in size or changing in shape or et cetera.
So let me ask you the question, and this may be not of a lot of interest to everybody we're listening to. It's of interest to me, and it may be interested to sophisticated listeners who really want to understand whether they really got a problem or not, and that's this issue of what's called subclinical hypothyroidism. I have read a little bit about it more recently. I'm kind of normally skeptical. I have not spent the time looking at all the literature to really say I feel comfortable, but what is it generally meant by subclinical hypothyroidism, and is this a real entity or not?
Well, I mean, it's certainly an area of active research. A lot of it is being done, and a lot of studies are being done to look at it. But it basically just means like someone that has very normal or fairly close to normal looking labs, but they seem to have a lot of other symptoms of hypothyroidism. Sometimes they can have just mild elevation in the TSH. You know, we're talking about 6 or 7 or 5. And they've even also tried to look at people in the normal range. So people that have TSHs in the upper half of the normal range versus the lower half. And they try to make all sorts of, I would say it's still quite an area of controversy. Mm-hmm. I think one area that is probably a little bit more relevant is we almost see a similar kind of pattern in these very obese children. And as you well know, you know, we're starting to see a number of kids with obesity in pediatrics. And we're learning actually that when children are very obese, another hormone made in the body called leptin, which is a hormone made in the fat tissue, we are learning that leptin actually can cause independent elevation in the TSH. So many of these kids coming in with mild elevation of their TSH and their obesity, it's probably driven not by any thyroid disease, but driven by excessive fatty tissue, excessive fat distribution. And the new guidelines are really that most of these kids with obesity without any other goiter or physical signs suggesting any thyroid disease, that it's probably simply driven by obesity. And so when they followed some of these kids and had them, were able to get them to lose weight, their TSH that was 5.5 or 6 would return back into the normal range. Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm hearing as a physician listening to you is that yeah, maybe there are some situations where that may be, but you really want to be careful of drug effects, obesity, other things that may be driving the abnormal level of TSH that you're measuring or the symptoms. So I hear you better get to a good endocrinologist and really get this clear so we don't end up getting over-treated.
Most definitely, because over-treatment leads to, weakening of the bones, potentially other side effects. You don't want to have to be on a medication if you don't really need it.
Yep. Here's another question that came out. I think it's a pretty good one. It says, "Hi, my mom took thyroid medication, and I wonder if thyroid conditions can be hereditary. What questions would I ask a pediatrician if I was concerned about my child?" So this guy, it's a man who sent, he's asking in a sense about himself, I guess, but also his offspring, since his mother had thyroid problems, it appears.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, I see families where the grandparents had acquired hypothyroidism. The parents have it, and then some of the children can develop it. And so, yes, if you have a family history like that, I think, again, it's very important that kids get good growth measurements, good physical exams at least once a year. Certainly, with your family history, I would bring that up with your pediatrician and make sure they try to palpate the thyroid gland, see if there's any abnormalities. And if there's concerns, a good screening would just be to measure a TSH level and see if it's within the normal range. Because we often, of course, as endocrinologists, like to see the free T4 as well as the TSH, but that can be a way that could be identified and picked up.
So let's go back to this question about, you had mentioned that people who are hypothyroid may be overweight, may be putting on weight, fluid retention may be part of the reasons for that. So let me ask the question a little bit differently. How often is thyroid disorders generally presenting with a person who has really significant problems with weight, being overweight, as their primary problem?
I can tell you, I don't think I've seen one patient with severe hypothyroidism that their presenting reason that this was picked up was because of weight gain.
Okay.
Weight gain is becoming a huge problem in the whole population. So obviously, I do see some kids that are severely hypothyroid that were overweight. But honestly, I think weight is very, very low on my list of issues to think about for hypothyroidism. I'd be a lot more focused on, how is their concentration ability at school? Are they having dry skin? Are they having constipation? But the things that I look at that are the most sensitive to pick it up would be growth rate. So is the kid growing 2 inches a year before puberty or 4 inches a year after puberty? Or if you see a kid with, other concerning signs, then obviously get them evaluated. But I was actually recently talking to one of my colleagues that practices endocrinology in the community, and she was telling me about a patient who, again, they didn't do a height measurement, and because of that, this kid with severe hypothyroidism got missed. This kid hasn't grown much at all in 4 years. The bone age was 4 years delayed, and that's a really good indication that this kid was severely hypothyroid for probably about 4 years or more. Mm-hmm. And that can have permanent effects on final height and stature, and occasionally it can even lead to early puberty. So it's really something important to identify, and virtually all those kids would get picked up if we had accurate heights once a year and we could see that that kid wasn't growing well.
And when you say not growing well, let me try to clarify that. There are groups of kids who are growing at a rate that is pretty normal but are small. And then there's the kid whose rate of growth is slowing down. Those are different issues. And what would thyroid hormone deficiency do?
Okay, so children who are growing at a normal rate, so 5 centimeters a year or 2 inches a year before puberty, these are kids that they could be below the third percentile. They may be what we call a late bloomer or kids with something called constitutional delay of growth in puberty. And if they're growing below the curve but at a normal physiologic rate, I'd be a lot less worried about that kid. But after about the age of 18 months to 2 years, definitely by 3 years of age, children are supposed to be growing 5 centimeters a year or 2 inches a year. And if they're not doing that, and we're starting to see that they're going from the 25th percentile to the 15th, 10th, 5, that's abnormal. And kids that are crossing percentiles after the age of 2 or who are in puberty and not growing at a pubertal growth rate, those would be the ones I would be most worried about.
So it's the rate of growth. There's lots of reasons why people may be short, but they're growing at the same rate, and that's really an important issue for trying to get across to parents.
Most definitely.
All right, let's take one more phone call that we have. We've only got a couple of minutes here. Melanie, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, I was just wondering what his take was on a brain injury and maybe a neck injury and how it would affect the pituitary gland and the thyroid and the hormones. I've been reading some articles from Dr. Gordon that he'd been treating traumatic brain injury patients coming back from the war with hormones.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't have a lot of specific knowledge of that. I mean, I mainly deal with pediatric patients, and fortunately, you know, but I would say, you know, I think one of the things that, have you read articles from these people, or have they published anything on this?
Yes, Dr. Mark Gordon, and he's in California, and he did some publishing on it.
Well, I would what I always tell people to do is I encourage people to get online, PubMed, the National Institutes of Health, and the Library of Medicine. I mean, it's a great resource to identify things like that, and I'm often doing that on a daily basis. So when I have a complex situation like you sound like you're dealing with, I like to talk to the smartest people I can, and now with the internet and email, you know, people don't mind you shoot them an email and just say, hey, do you have any idea what I should do or what other evaluation should we do? And they can put that in perspective. And other times, too, they have clinical trials that they're doing or ways that people can get enrolled. And sometimes you can do that even from here in Alaska, and they can enroll you in a study in California and maybe see if that would be helpful for you. But I think that would probably be the best way to get your question answered in the best way.
Okay, yeah, I just thought maybe if you'd had any experience with children with brain injuries and had worked with hormones.
A small number, but I haven't had too many of them that develop hypothyroidism.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for your call, Melanie. All right, we're getting close to the end. This is a time when I often like to kind of let guests sum things up. Is there some important lessons here about thyroid disease we want to make sure people know about?
Well, again, I think for those individuals with children and for children themselves, I realize that, you know, thyroid hormone is very essential for growth and for normal puberty. The most sensitive way we can identify thyroid hormone deficiency is with looking at growth. And even hyperthyroid patients they sometimes can have overgrowth or be a little taller in stature than they should be. Sometimes that bone age may advance. That's an X-ray, and we know that happens because of the hormones of puberty that act on the bones. So I think growth and a yearly checkup at your pediatrician or family doctor is the best way to try to prevent your kid from having long-term hypothyroidism and its other deleterious effects.
Okay, thanks very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and we'll have to have you come back. There's some of the issues about growth and diabetes, of course, would be interesting to talk about. We didn't get to vitamin D, which we talked about, which I understand you've talked about on KSKA before, but is also a very interesting topic and pertinent up here particularly.
Most definitely. Yeah, definitely.
All right. My thanks again to Anchorage pediatric endocrinologist Dr. Matthew Benson. And if you'd like to continue this conversation on childhood thyroid disease, you can join KSKA on Facebook. You can find that link at www.alaskapublic.org. Our next program, we're going to be focusing on efforts to improve quality and improve healthcare costs. Our guest will be Dr. Richard Antonelli. He's the medical director for integrated care at Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. So why not tune in and learn more Monday, October 28th at 2 p.m. Remember, we repeat each Monday evening at 9 p.m. on 91.1 KSKA. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Kristen Platt is our web editor and engineer today. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.